Well, let's do this. This time, now in my case, it's a whole new book, and literally it's a whole new book because I have printed out the specialized translations with the Hebrew on the one column and the English on the other column, and that's what I use for studying and teaching and so forth because it gives me a lot more room to write. But for those of you that just have a single book there, turn instead to the book or the chapter, bunch of chapters, that marks where we are tonight, which is the beginning of Leviticus, or in the Hebrew, Vayikra. And it goes something like this. As you know, not only is the name of the Parsha based on the first few unique words in each individual breakdown, but of course, when that Parsha begins a new book, as it does tonight, it is the first few words that name the book in the Hebrew as well. And it says this, Vayikra al Moshe, and called unto Moshe, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yahuwah. And he spoke to him out of the tent of meeting, and then we get the words in red, and then he tells them the following, which we'll get to in just a second. But I'm going to pause there, make a couple comments about where we are and what's going on here. A couple of interesting things. First, some of you may have heard about the so-called jots and tittles. We have one of those here, Vayikra. And literally, in the if you see a real Torah scroll or a replica of a real Torah scroll, what you will notice is that this little aleph at the end of that word is small. And of course, the question is why? Well, there's no idle word in Scripture, and indeed, there's probably no idle character. When you see things that are done deliberately that are a little bit different, it's worth checking out. And essentially, it goes something like this. This root word, the yod kof resh there, can be, well, conjugated, I guess you'd say. It can appear in the Hebrew in a couple of different forms. And one of those forms is that this is a chance happening. It's like, I just happened to be out around and shazam, there was so-and-so. And that's one reference in the word. And then there's this other one, Vayikra. And the way Rashi explains this is what that means. No chance to it at all. And it was done with love. And not only that, that kind of is emphasized a little bit by the fact that, hey, isn't this strange? This chapter actually starts as if it was a continuation of the last book. Because it starts with an and, right? And that's normally the understanding, and something happens, well, it followed something else happening. So what else? And Yahuwah called with love unto Moshe and said the following thing. So it's where we begin here is a continuation of some things that have been said before. Let's see, got a question already on the screen. Which aleph are you referencing in the verse? And it's the very, very first aleph in the very first word of the very first verse. And it says in English, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh called to Moshe. But remember, in the Hebrew it really reads, and called to Moshe. And then it gets on to telling us who called and what he said. And the Vayikra, the last ah, the aleph, in that first word that I'm talking about there, Tirtza. So here's what he said. And then we're going to pause. We're going to talk a little bit about things that are kind of out of order than the way I sometimes do it on Friday night, which is to go through the text and more or less hit the high points of the story. Well, we're at a place now where there's not so much story, and that is one of the confusing factors for folks, too. There's a lot of information here about something that we often just plain can't relate to anymore. Speak unto the children of Israel and say to them, when any man among you brings an offering unto Yahuwah, you're to bring an offering of the cattle, or the herd, or of the flock. Offering, sacrifice. That word there is korban in the Hebrew. Got another quick question. Where do you see the words in love? Now, I thought I'd explain it. Maybe I didn't do a very good job. Sorry. In other words, the difference is the fact that the sages, and as you know, I get a kick out of Rashi a lot of times. I somehow resonate with his understandings. He seems to really have a kind of an eye, or did, I guess it's been a while, to pick out certain things, and certainly this is one of those things, the differences between the words. So the idea that this is with love is not in the text explicitly. It's in there implicitly in both the way that the choice of words here lays out, the conjugation, and that ending aleph there that we talked about. Okay, so hopefully that's clear. Again, you don't necessarily have to see it that way, and it's not something that can easily be proved. We're just talking about some nuance here. But unlike things that are sometimes made up out of whole cloth, and I always take some interest in that, right? You know, we can maybe learn something from the context, and there might be some value in it. But when it comes to the language, too, I do find, at least personally, that it is really interesting to look into the nuances of the way things are translated, because sometimes we can get some real insight by doing it that way. There's another example of that coming up right here, because it says the following. Now I'm gonna go to. I've got some notes on this one as well. When any man among you brings an offering unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. When anyone among you brings an offering unto Yahuwah, you shall bring your offering of the cattle. Well, here is how the rendering in the Hebrew literally reads. Okay? You don't generally see it translated like this into the English. And I won't go through the Hebrew in detail, because I know that, all we got to do is really understand that there is a difference here, that is a distinction. Literally, it seems to translate as when one of you, one man, Adom, offers a sacrifice of you. Now say what? Almost doesn't make any sense, does it? We're talking about Leviticus 1:2. When one of you offers a sacrifice to Yahuwah, the sacrifice must be taken. Well, we've already read that. But... And here I'm looking at, there were a number of people that have written about this over the years, as you might expect, because it is kind of an unusual set of words. Here's how Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks puts it, and he does a pretty good job of explaining it, so I'll just read one paragraph of this. This is how it would read, when one of you offers a sacrifice to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, if it were constructed according to the normal rules of Hebrew grammar. However, in particular, in this sentence, the word order is strange. It's unexpected. And he says what we would expect to read in the Hebrew is Adam mikem yi ki yakriv, when one of you offers a sacrifice. But that's not what it says. It says Adam ki yakriv mikem. The words are the reverse order. And so literally it means when one offers a sacrifice of you. Huh? When one offers a sacrifice of you. Now, the sacrifice is going to be of the cattle, of the herds, and so forth. What I want to do is I want to go through a couple of elements of this. I'm not going to do the whole story because there's a lot of interesting detail in here. I'll probably spend some more time talking about this tomorrow. But essentially, what it boils down to is that the sages have said over the years, you know what? What this is really saying, no idle word in Torah, is that the sacrifice is being offered from ourselves. Certainly, we bring to Elohim our faculties, our energies, our thoughts, our emotions, and there's a whole lot more detail about the kinds of things that are to be sacrificed here. And you'll note, and I'll go through this in a bit more detail in a second, that the various sacrifices all share certain kind of common characteristics. They're animals, and they're, if you will, they're clean animals, too. And they're herd animals. And again, like I said, I'm going to skip over some of the detail here. But I do think for now that is worth pointing out. The sacrifice is of us. It is an element of us that's being sacrificed. And tomorrow we'll probably go into quite a bit more detail on how it is that makes sense. But for now, what I want to do is just step back a second and say, okay, look, we've already gotten just three verses into this thing, and there's a whole lot of discussion about sacrifices, about offerings. Literally, whether you talk to rabbinic Jews or Christians, you will hear almost universally, well, you know, this is kind of boring. really. We don't make sacrifices anymore. The mainstream Christians will say, oh, once and for all, Jesus died on the cross, that's the sacrifice, end of story. I'm going to suggest to you, no, it's not even the end of the story. There's a whole lot more to it, and there's a lot of stuff that's gotten twisted over the years, and maybe a little bit more examination of this particular parsha will help to put some of those errors into place for us. So I'm going to do a little bit of that tonight. I'm also going to note that, most rabbinic Jews will say, hey, you know, we haven't had an operating place to do the sacrifices, a temple. Second temple period ended in 70 of the current era, 70 A.D. Haven't had one for therefore the better part of 2,000 years or so. So, we as Jews can't relate to that either. What's really going on here? A couple of the comments that I'm going to reference tonight, I got a kick out of from David Foreman. You know that Rabbi David Foreman does a video, and I like him a lot. There again are half a dozen people that I read regularly, and several that I tend to quote more than others, and David Foreman is one of those. How do I want to begin this? I want to step back and just say, okay, let's look at some patterns in the Scripture. Now, normally, again, I would go through from chapter 1 through chapter 5, which is this Torah portion, and pretty well hit some of the high points and make sure we talked about the main things. But tonight, at least up front, what I'm going to do is kind of break this portion up and say, look, this makes a lot more sense if we do two things. We do it on occasion, but I'm going to do it in more detail tonight. One of those is talk about the Hebrew. I've already started down that path. We're going to do it a bit more, because if we're talking about, well, sacrifices, and this sacrifice is of you, or offerings, doesn't it make sense that we at least understand the context? If we're supposed to make a sacrifice of us, well, what are we looking for? Does it still apply? Does it have anything to say to us nowadays at all? I'm going to contend, of course, that it does. He is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. He hasn't changed. So what can we learn from this stuff that seems so, literally, 2 millennia out of date? From either tradition, whether it's a Jewish tradition or a Christian tradition, they'll tell you for different reasons this doesn't apply anymore. And I believe it does. So the word that is key here, we've already addressed, korban. Korban, that word that means sacrifice or offering unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And then we're going to talk about some other words, because we have different types of korban. And literally, it's like chapter 1 is going to talk about the olah. You might hear it called the burnt offering. There are some other words that will apply here, too. We'll get back to that in a second. Then we have, chapter 2, which is kind of an aside. The mincha, the grain offering. I'm going to actually skip over that. We're going to come back to that one, because it is, in some respects, a little bit different. Oftentimes, the grain offering has to do with people that can't afford to make the burnt offering. Then we got the third chapter of the portion tonight, Vayikra chapter 3. This is the shlamim. You'll hear it pronounced different ways, but you recognize that? Shlamim. Shlamim, shalom, right? Shabbat shalom. You know the root word there is shalom, peace offering. So yeah, we'll hear it called a peace offering. We'll also hear it called an offering of well-being. Okay, and then we get to chapter 4, and then to 5, which is a follow-on. Some elements of that. That offering is called chatat. Which, oftentimes it gets rendered a sin offering, but there's a little bit more to it. So we'll come back to all of that. I did see a question. We'll come back to that one, Tirtza, because it sounds like it's a repetition, and I'm sorry, we do have some problems, and if I keep trying to repeat things, I might end up all night, because we'll probably have another dropout during the time that I would repeat that as well. So we'll hopefully I'll answer it one way or the other for you. So make sure that you get to me and I get it answered, even if we don't do it right now. Let's then talk a little bit about the specifics of some of these things. Okay, first off, this burnt offering. Speak to the children of Israel, right? Verse 2. And when you bring an offering of yourselves unto Yahuwah, it's going to be one of several things. From the cattle of the herd or of the flock. If it's a burnt offering of the herd of cattle, it's to be a male without blemish. He brings it to the door of the tent of meeting. And this is an element that seems to be kind of common to a lot of this. The person who brings the offering lays his hand upon the head. It's to make atonement for him. And then it gets killed. Aaron's sons, or Aaron, or the people who follow on after him, will present the blood and dash it against the altar at the door of the tent of meeting. And then it gets flayed and ultimately laid upon the fire, and it is burned. Which takes us back to this idea of the word olah. The burned offering literally means ascending offering, or maybe you could just say it as up. And the key thing is, it's all offered. We see at the end of the of chapter 1 that it is an offering made by fire of a sweet savor unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. So, Leviticus 1, a burnt offering, key here is that it's voluntary and that it is consumed. It goes up, it ascends, it is olah. All right, chapter 2, when a soul brings a type of korban, which is mincha, which is meal unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, puts oil upon it, and frankincense. He brings it to Aaron's son, and they take a handful of it, and they take that too, and they make out of a part of it a smoke, sweet fire, sweet savor unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. In this case, some of it's left over. That belongs to Aaron and his sons. It is set apart. And when you bring a meal offering that's baked in an oven, there's instructions about that. It's to be unleavened cakes, unleavened, kind of like what we see at Pesach, of fine flour mingled with oil, spread with oil. And sounds kind of good, right? Makes you hungry. Break it in pieces, put oil upon it. It is a meal offering. And there's some more specifications to it. Oh, we get to the end of the section here. It says one more thing. Every meal offering is to be seasoned with salt. You're to offer the salt of the covenant to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Don't let it be lacking. With all your offerings, make sure you include salt. Verse 14 says something here where there's another little bit of interesting connotation in the Hebrew. This is one of those places where you get a disagreement between Rashi and the Rambam in particular. The word here is va'im. We know im usually means if, right? And if you bring a meal offering of first fruits unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, you're to bring it, the meal offering, your first fruits, corn in the ear parched with fire. Put oil upon it and so forth. Well, Rashi says, you know, really, that word can have multiple meanings, the word im. And in this case, because it is going to happen sometimes. Some of these are voluntary offerings, but this one, first fruits, is supposed to happen at least annually, perhaps more often. So that means that it's not a question of if, but when. So he contends that the better rendering of this is and when you bring that meal offering. All right, let's get back to the theme here of the different types of korban and the words that describe the different types. We've got one of them already, the burnt offering, the olah that is ascending. It goes up. It is consumed, turned into a sweet savor. Smoke. Then we have this next one, chapter 3, that we're now getting to, shalomim. Root word shalom, right? Peace offering, offering of well-being. And the key word here is going to be shared. That this offering is a shared offering. So if this person brings a sacrifice of peace offerings, if he offers from the herd, could be male or female, it is to be, again, without blemish. You don't bring a blemished animal and get rid of that one by offering it. And again, the person who brings it lays his hand upon it. It's killed at the door of the tent of meeting. And Aaron's sons, the priests, dash the blood against the altar round about. He presents the sacrifice of peace offerings, offering made by fire again, of the fat. The fat that's upon the innards, then there's a description of all the different kinds of things that go here, the kidneys, the fat that's on them, the loins, lobe above the liver. And Aaron's sons make all of this smoke upon the offer, upon the wood, on the fire. It is an offering made by fire, a sweet savor unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. If his offering for a sacrifice of peace offerings is of the flock, a sheep or similar, in other words, male or female, it's also without blemish. If it's a lamb, he presents it before Yahuwah. Again, he lays his hands on it. Same thing happens with the blood and the fat thereof. Description of where that goes, the kidneys and so forth, makes it smoke upon the altar. It is an offering made by fire. Similarly, if it's a goat, he presents it, puts his hand upon it, and the blood gets dashed by the sons of Aaron on the altar. And similar with the innards here. This is to be, end of the chapter, a perpetual statute, there's that word again, olam, throughout your generations and all your dwellings. Oh, that you eat neither fat nor blood. Eat neither fat nor blood. Now we recognize this prohibition against blood. The life is in the blood. Now we get to chapter 4. We're going to see the third of the three main kinds of korban that are laid out here. And this is called the sin offering, the chatat offering. Speak unto the children of Israel, Moshe is told, saying, if anyone shall sin through error in any of the things which Yahuwah has commanded not to be done, and he does one of them, well, then there's going to be some things that follow from that. But let's pause here and make a couple of comments about this, because this is where I think things really begin to get interesting. Note that we've been talking up until now about a voluntary offering. Somebody just brings this offering because they want to. Peace offering, burnt offering, they're voluntary. At this point, the chatat offering is, technically, I guess you could say it's not voluntary. Now, the key is, at least somebody has to figure out, if it's done through error, there's a time where you end up saying, oops, uh-oh, I did do something. Now there is to be this offering that's made for that unintentional sin. And again, the word there in the Hebrew is chatat. There are some more directions in chapter 4 about the specifics of who might do something. If it's an anointed priest, one of the Levites that sins, so as to bring guilt on the people, then let him offer for his sin, which he sinned, a young bullock, also without blemish. He brings it to the door of the tent of meeting. He, in turn, just like before, lays his hands, kills it before Yahuwah, takes the blood, brings it to the tent of meeting. The priest dips his finger in it, sprinkles the blood 7 times before Yod Heh Vav Heh in front of the veil of the sanctuary. Puts the blood upon the horns of the altar of sweet incense before Yahuwah in the tent of meeting. All the remaining blood of the bullock he pours out at the base of the altar. And the fat he takes off, covers the innards, the fat on the innards. Again, the same description of the organs, 2 kidneys, the fat, the lobe above the liver, is taken off of the sacrifice of peace offerings. He makes them smoke. But the skin, the flesh, the head, the innards, the dung, the whole is to be carried forth now outside the camp unto a clean place. And it's burned on wood with fire. Then we get another variation of the chatat, the sin offering here. What about now if the whole congregation sins? This thing being hid from the eyes of the assembly. Now, if they do something which is either commanded to be done or not to be done, a sin of omission or commission, then what? Well, when it becomes known, then the assembly this time offers a young bullock for a sin offering, brings it before the tent of the meeting, and it's the elders, the representatives, if you want to think of it that way, that lay their hands upon the head of the bullock. He, the bullock, is killed before Yahuwah, and the blood again is taken to the tent of meeting. Priest dips his finger in it, sprinkles it 7 times before Yahuwah in front of the veil, puts the blood on the horns of the altar in the tent of meeting, and all the remaining blood again is poured out at the base of the altar at the door. And the fat, same thing, happens there. And the rest of the bullock is carried outside and it's burned. This, it says, is a sin offering, chatat, for the assembly. Now let's pause and ask some questions here. What do we got? We've got a couple of different things going on. We're starting to see a pattern emerge of some kind or other. The things that are consistent are, we have different kinds of offerings, voluntary, and in the latter case, the chatat case, not necessarily voluntary. And they all involve an animal that's clean, that we're told is basically edible. One of the common threads here, in other words, is food. Eat. Now, I like the way I mentioned up front, I was going to talk about a couple things that Rabbi David Foreman pointed out. He introduces it by saying, let's talk about the domain here. Whose domain are we talking about? The Bible begins by noting that our Creator created the world and us, and He gave us a domain within His domain. In the garden of the domain that He made for us. So essentially you could say, well, let's know whether we're talking about man's domain or God's domain, if you will. And then let's talk about one other aspect, too, of things that divided us from Him, from fellowship with Him, and things that we look to restore fellowship. I think, I'll explain it this way, ever get together with friends for a meal? It's a great way to have fellowship. Table fellowship, you'll even hear it called. Let's get out and let's break bread together, right? Let's share some food. There's no small amount of irony in the fact that it was food that got man kicked out of the garden in the first place. There was only one easy command. Don't eat this one thing. You need anything else you want except for this particular, this fruit from, in this case, two trees. But particularly it was that fruit of this knowledge of the tree, good and evil. So man ate something he should not eat. Forbidden food. And how are we now seeing all this stuff laid out that looks like some kind of way, somehow or other, yeah, it's complicated, yeah, there's a lot of instruction here, yeah, we think this doesn't apply anymore, but somehow or other, this has to do with restoration of right relationship, and imagine that. Again, we're talking food. Eat. In a lot of cases, this is food that either smells really good, or is offered up, and or the priests get to eat a lot of it, or in some cases we're going to see that there's another kind of fellowship where we all get together and have a great big barbecue. But the common thread, at least in part, is eat, food. And all of these things have to do with restoring the balance. I heard another discussion, this by the way appeals to me as an engineer because I've talked about these kind of things before. What is restoring the balance? Well, when I get nerdy and I say, hey, look, you know, you can look at the equations of motion of the universe, you can look at the essential equations that describe all of the way that everything in the universe literally works, this underdamped or damped exponential, a sine wave, e to the minus t, stdt. Okay, it's something that has kind of a sinusoidal shape to it. We see cycles and cycles and cycles, and it either grows or it's damped. Gets bigger or gets smaller over time. And there are some other laws of the universe we kind of recognize too. A fellow named Isaac Newton came up with a couple of them. Thermodynamics, but also one of the most famous ones, objects in motion tend to remain in motion. Newton's first law. And then the other one, second law, that has to do with what happens when there's a force applied. Well, we get for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? You push in one direction, there's a force that pushes back. When I was in college and we took a class called statics and then later one called dynamics, you could basically take any particular thing you wanted. You want to build something that stays in place? Well, you recognize that if you have all these forces acting on it and it doesn't break or move, it means that the total of all the little vectors pushing on this thing must be zero. Force in one direction, force in another direction. If they're not equal, the thing moves. It accelerates even. Why am I doing all this? All right, it has to do with the fact that there are laws. You could even call it Torot instructions, the way the universe is built, and that for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. The equations have to balance. And you know what? I think that applies to what we're talking about here with these offerings as well. And it's why this idea of eating resonates, and that these burned offerings and well-being offerings and even unintentional sin offerings somehow or other all seem to be associated with making right something or asking for peace or just offering something up because we love Him or because we've done wrong. But they're about restoring the balance one way or another, and they involve food. I'm going to mention one other thing. I know this is a little bit risky because I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking on it, at least not right now. But there's a place in the apostolic writings where, and this is one of those few places in Scripture that is literally called by the disciples, the apostles, a hard teaching. And whether we have an exact translation or not, I've always questioned. But there's a reference where Yahushua talks about, eat my flesh and drink my blood, right? What? Did he really say that? What's he talking about here? This is a hard teaching. Who can know this? And then the description even goes on to say a whole lot of folks left after hearing that. And it's still confusing. You know what? In large part, I think it's because people ignore stuff like Vayikra. And they don't, well, it doesn't apply anymore. You know, that one sacrifice for all, end of story. Wait a minute. If you don't read the book, if you don't study line by line, precept by precept, and start at the beginning, you don't understand why all these things play out. You miss some of the real simple stuff. Doesn't it at least make a certain amount of sense that these sacrifices, this korban, and I like that term better than I do sacrifice. Why? Because really we're talking about, in some cases, offerings. Sometimes voluntary, sometimes required. So korban is a better word than the one that carries a lot of baggage in the English. Let's start there. And let's say, okay, again, what's some of the common elements? Well, they have to do with animals. I've already mentioned this idea of the animal has a nefesh. It has a life force. You could call it a soul if you want. That might be distinct from something called a spirit. But we're supposed to make an offering of us. Are we supposed to make human sacrifices? Of course not. But we do make, when a man among you offers a sacrifice of you, then here's all this instruction about it. If we don't understand this, if we just say it's all done away with, or it doesn't apply because there's a temple anymore, it's all done away with because Jesus nailed this stuff to the cross, we miss the whole point. And then we certainly don't understand the references to eating. We don't understand the references to blood and to life and literally to restoring the balance, to getting the equations to pan out. And if you want to go back to the simple part at the beginning, this is why I like the way that it was laid out in some of the things that David Foreman was pointing out. Go back to the garden. Genesis chapter 3, right? The reason why the rest of the book is there is because there was some big screw-up happened in Genesis chapter 3, and the rest of the book, regardless of where, you know, depending on whether you're talking to a Christian or a Jew, whether they think that book ends, you know, at that magic page that says old on one side, new on the other, or whether it ends later, doesn't so much matter. We're still talking about a whole lot of stuff that applies to, you messed up, I knew the end from the beginning, says Yod Heh Vav Heh, and this is about restoring the balance. You can't skip over Vayikra chapter 1 and the first set of parashot here and think that you're going to get it if we believe it doesn't apply anymore. There is something really key about fellowship and about eating and about this sweet savor unto Yod Heh Vav Heh and to the essence of what it is that makes up this various type of korban. Now, let me talk about one other thing that also tends to be really, really divisive. I'm going to refer to this as the elephant in the room. And that is the following. If you go through all this korban and you put them in charts, and you make, okay, we got the olah, we got the shalamim, we got the chatat offerings, we got different kinds of other offerings for people that don't have as much money, minha, grain offerings, and so forth. Lots of confusing stuff. We haven't even gotten to chapter 5 yet. We'll get there in a minute, about restitution, the guilt offering, asham. But when you do go through all of that, when you lay out all these offerings and you see, okay, there's various things when somebody sins accidentally, when a priest sins accidentally, when the whole congregation sins accidentally. Oh, let's go right back to verse 22 for a second. When a ruler sins, a king, a prince, accidentally, he does something through error, any one of the things which Yahuwah has commanded should not be done, he's guilty. Well, then he does the following, and it's going to sound very similar. If any one of the common people sin through error, they do something accidentally, which Yahuwah has commanded not to be done. Well, they got to figure it out at some time. Right, well, I mentioned the elephant in the room. What is it? What we see being laid out here in all of this discussion of Corbone is this picture. It's a beautiful picture of all these kinds of things that can happen and do happen, and that can happen voluntarily or that can happen by accident, and it's about restoring the balance, balancing the equations, eating things that shouldn't have been et to begin with. He knew better. Adam and Chava knew better. And then we're going to do some other kind of eating associated with food somehow to put things back in balance. Is it a done deal yet? No, there's obviously something more going on here. Well, it's almost like there's this great big picture being painted with a huge, obvious, glaring hole in the middle. And this is the elephant in the room thing. This is one of the things that I like to talk about because my contention, as most of you know, is that if you go to Rabbinic Judaism, and, you know, I have wonderful friends, people that I love dearly, that are rabbis, and that are very knowledgeable Orthodox Jews. I even got some friends that that are atheist Jews. And I find that a lot of times when it comes to Judaism, honestly, there's not a lot of in-between. Yeah, there's Reform Judaism. But you generally tend to find, at least in my experience, most of folks either very much Torah observant, very much curious and characteristic, or they fall into the camp of, you know, I really don't care so much. Just like Christians, I'll go on Easter Sunday, I'll go for Pesach, but, you know, I don't do much else. Yeah. Well, wherever people on the side of the Rabbinic Judaism aisle, if you will, fall into that camp, there's something missing. And the same thing is true of the virtually pagan stuff that has been done to us by the Roman Catholic Church. Let's get rid of everything. Let's claim Jesus nailed it all to the cross. All you got to do is just begin to read Scripture and realize that that too is a big lie. Because he didn't do that. The fellow whose name was Yahushua and who came and in the very, very first public address he ever gave said, I'm not going to change not the smallest part, not one yod nor tittle. So long as heaven and earth still exist, it'll all be fulfilled. So already we got a big problem. What am I trying to say here? Well, you know, basically there's two houses and they've both got problems. You can read Ezekiel chapter 23, Jeremiah 3. You can read the whole history of the northern and southern kingdoms and see, yep, both Israel and Judah out whoring. Who's Israel? Who's Judah? Well, people can argue about all that. What did Jesus do on the cross? Was it once and for all, end of story, end of the deal? Well, no, because if we go back and read Vayikra, we'll see that there's more to it. So what I'm trying to say is the following, and this is where, in an effort to try and at least bridge the gap and say, look, I'm not at all convinced that either one of the two houses, the two camps, has it all right. I tell the joke about the Reese's peanut butter commercial, right? You got your peanut butter and my chocolate? No, you got your chocolate and my peanut butter. There are things that both houses can learn from the other. Scripture, I believe, the two sticks of Ezekiel, many, many, many other references, the regathering, we're going to see a lot of that happen. So it helps us, it behooves us to kind of have an open mind. And I think a lot of that begins with a study, an honest study of Vayikra and of these korbonim. Hope that's right. Anyway, of Korbon, the various offerings, and what we can learn from them. Because, okay, I've been painting around it. What's the glaring big hole in the middle? Yeah, it's obvious, right? Intentional sin. Adam, at the insistence of his wife, remember, you failed, because you listened to her, said Yod Heh Vav Heh, bad stuff's going to happen. Well, bad stuff is still happening. Men are still walking. And by men, I mean men and women. Still walking in rebellion. We see all kinds of idolatry. We see other kinds of things going on. And you know what? People either knew or should have known better. So we've got all this nice discussion in Vayikra here, chapters 4 and 5, about people that do things accidentally. But what we're missing is this idea of utter rebellion. What is the sacrifice for somebody who just plain knows better and commits an act of utter rebellion like Adam did? Funny. It's not explicitly described here. Now we get to chapter 5, And it does talk about if one sins, and well, there's a number of elements to this. Touches something that was unclean, a carcass, and it's hidden. If he touches the uncleanness of a man, and it's hidden, but he finds out about it, and he knows. If he swears with his lips to do something, to do evil or good, and it's hidden. When he finds out about it, he confesses, and then he brings his forfeit now unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh for the sin, and then it describes what that is, a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat for a sin offering. The priest makes atonement. Then it describes again, hey, what if he doesn't have enough means for a lamb? Well, we're going to work our way down through a turtle dove or a pigeon. Two young turtle doves, two young pigeons in this case. And what happens with those? And finally, we get down to the point where it could be mincha. Then there's a trespass. And then we get to this. Okay, when somebody does something where there is harm done, they make restitution. They make restitution. They add a fifth part to give it back to the priest. If one sins and commits a trespass against Yahuwah, notice that it's against Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, deals falsely with his neighbor in a matter of deposit or pledge or robbery, or oppresses his neighbor, he found something which was lost and he dealt falsely about that, or he swore to a lie, all of these things a man can do. If he sins and is guilty, he is to restore that which he took by robbery or got by oppression or found and should ought to have given back but didn't. All those things which he's sworn falsely, he restores in full. He adds a fifth part to it. And then he also brings his forfeit unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. In this case, it's a ram without blemish out of the flock, according to the valuation, for a guilt offering to the priest. He makes atonement, he shall be forgiven. We're still seeing that even in the cases where there is a problem, somebody done something wrong, they're to make right, and then still bring this idea of restitution into play. That is key. We're going to see that throughout the Torah. You make restitution for this guilt offering, this idea of a sham. Where I'm going to wrap it up, I guess, and leave it there, because that takes us through the end of chapter 5. That's the end of the Torah portion this evening, is let's try to be a little bit more open-minded about the kinds of things that we're told, well, you know, from Rabbinic Judaism, you can't do anyway because these sacrifices can't be offered. We don't have a temple anymore. Don't worry about it. Or Jesus did them once and for all, so don't worry about them either. And, of course, that overlooks the fact that, hey, what kind of sacrifice are we talking? Well, if we'll read what the claim is, he was the sacrifice, they say, for deliberate rebellion. And I think that makes an interesting case. But then to go on and say that they didn't do any of these other things is, you know, flies in the face of history and what Scripture says too. Because we know, for example, that Paul took a Nazarite vow after the same guy started writing about and talking about, you know, what Yeshua did for him. And yet, he still made some of these other offerings. So again, the key here is to understand. Go look at what it's actually is written there, line by line, precept by precept. And try to understand the common ground and what Scripture is really getting us to go do. I believe, and we'll talk about this when we get to the news in just a few minutes, that we're at a place where this is more important than most of us are willing to admit. Not because of the sacrifices in a temple, per se, but because of the understanding. How do we get the equations to balance? We still got some things that need to happen before we see the end of the book, before we see the regathering. And certainly all of us need to start getting right with one another and with our Creator. And somehow or other, I can't help but think that there is a big element of table fellowship involved in that. Eat. And make sure that we understand, too, what it means when a man among you brings an offering of himself unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. How do we do that? All right, any questions, comments? Did I miss anything on the screen? Okay, who kills the animal? In general, it's the priest, although I'll admit, Kevin, I know why you're asking that question. There are a couple places where it says he. And as I read that, I know that the common understanding is that it's the priest that performs the kosher kill, although it certainly looks like from the text, and I'm not going to argue that it might be the person that brings it as well. In other cases, we know that it's the priest that does these things, and the priest certainly, throughout most of history, were the ones that would perform the actual slaying. It was the individual who brought the animal, though, that would put their hands on the head. And I guess, to my mind, and I didn't emphasize this as much as I have sometimes, I think there's an element of that also resonates with us. I've been involved in the past with other fellowships prior to Pesach, where we would go get a lamb, and we would prepare this lamb for the congregation, or maybe several lambs. And we would do as close as we can get anyway, to a reasonably kosher kill, slicing the jugular vein of the animal. And having done it, there's an emotional something that goes on there that you just plain don't get when you go down to King Soopers or Dillon's or whatever your local food store chain may be and buy a little bit of lamb or a side of beef or whatever it may be that the butcher has carved up for you. Because there's an element of understanding that there is an animal here, one way or the other, that has given up its life. It's nefesh. The blood is back into the ground as part of a process that we can be nourished and eat and maybe even begin to understand some of these other things. So let's leave it there. Yeah, Tirsa, let's come back to that. I guess I can do it real quickly. The answer in general is simply that is a Rashi-ism. And it has to do with the difference between the Hebrew root words and the way that word vayikra, ending in the aleph, the small aleph there, as opposed to another conjugation of the same root word that can mean it just kind of sort of happened. In other words, somebody can be called because, hey, there he is, or because he wanted them. And Rashi's claim is that if you go look at the language and you do the comparisons of the way that the word is conjugated, that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is calling unto Moshe explicitly and by name, and therefore, we don't see the words with love in the Hebrew, but therefore that there's this specific on-purpose understanding of the calling that goes on, and the fact that it is an and, that this is a continuation from where we left off the previous book. So hopefully that's a brief restatement of the answer. Okay, let's see. Is that a question from Tracy? No grain offering shall be made with chametz leaven. So yeah, that's true. And it's a good point. She's essentially pointing out that it has to do with the fact that the pagans did certain things. And oftentimes in Scripture, even if we don't necessarily see it pointed out, there were things that historians and or the people that have a good grounding in the sociology will tell us are rooted in pagan practice, and so sometimes Scripture will point that out or simply say, don't do this, and that's the reason. Okay, I see the question again. She's asking about a small aleph. Okay, it's not a lowercase aleph. This is a little teeny aleph. Literally, if you were to get a Torah scroll, and if you can find a chumash, or a Hebrew-English interlinear Bible. But in any case, if you can find the Hebrew rendering of it, you will look and see that the ones that have the ability, you know, if it's not a computer font, sometimes they don't have the ability, but in a printed font, that little aleph at the end of that word, vayikra, aleph, is tiny. It is noticeably smaller, physically, shrunken, from a normal-sized aleph. So hopefully that answers it. Okay, and then, yeah, Kevin's talking about the fact that sometimes the And the Hebrew does tend to look like this, at least in the beginning, chapter 1 there and other places, where the man kills the animal himself, and then the priest takes over from there. So I'm not going to argue with that. If I had to guess, and from what I've read, again, extra-biblical sources, the priests were more than happy to go ahead and do that if somebody was squeamish or if it was, who knows what the situation might be. I'm willing to bet that over the centuries, though, in a lot of cases, the man or the person who brought the offering did it themselves, and in other cases, the priests probably took over for most of the process. But again, I agree, the language does tend to look like it's the person who brings it in at least those first few cases.